Okay, so let's get started. Thank you for attending session 124 titled The Beauty of Mormon Theology, William H. Chamberlain and Making Mormonism True. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Lori Molman. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and therapist here in Salt Lake City. Super glad to be here. Before we begin, we ask that you turn your cell phones off or on, I think, on mute, and ask those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind while engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. I think we have a good group. I'm not concerned. I think we're going to be all right in here today. I think we're going to be okay. This is classic Sunstone today. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, seven issues for the price of six at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom, hosted by Benchmark Books. You couldn't miss it as you walked in. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and the presenter to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Okay, now I've read all that I'm required to say. Our story is so beautiful that even if it wasn't true, there is no reason that we can't make it true. God needs willing earthly hands to build Zion. It can't be built by celestial beings alone. That is a quote by William H. Chamberlain. Chamberlain was one of the first Mormons to study philosophy and biblical criticism and was blacklisted from teaching for church education. The statement that we could make Mormonism true references Mormonism's doctrines that humans are divine, creative beings, and that the highest form of truth is activity toward the creation of an ethical, just, and loving world. Our presenter, James McLaughlin, is a professor of philosophy and religion at Western Carolina University and the co-editor of Element, the Journal of the Society of Mormon Philosophy and Theology. He is currently working on a biography of William H. Chamberlain. There'll be a Q&A after his remarks.
It's been a few years since I've been at Sunstone. There's a conference that I always have to be at, a personalist seminar, and it actually happens at my university. So I have to leave right after a couple of sessions today and go to it. But this is the first time I've had a window to be here. Part of that was because I was on sabbatical this year. I was out here in Utah working on a book on hell. So I write about hell. Can't hear me? Oh, I'll talk louder. Okay, good. Okay, how many of you ever heard of William Chamberlain? Hey, there's three people. Good. No, four. We're doing pretty good. William Chamberlain was the first Mormon to study philosophy, formally, okay? Born in 1870 in Salt Lake City, went on his mission to the Society Islands, Tahiti, translated the Doctrine and Covenants into Tahitian. Those days you could get away with doing a lot of things, so he read John Dewey through his whole mission. He taught at Brigham Young College, which used to be up in Logan, Utah, not Brigham Young University. Was a math professor, but then started going to the University of Chicago and studying philosophy and Hebrew Bible. Took a master's degree in 1906 at University of California at Berkeley with a guy named George Holmes Howison, who I'll be talking about a little bit. Then went to Harvard and studied with Josiah Royce. Royce, if you know anything about the history of American philosophy, Royce is one of the most important American philosophers, along with William James, John Dewey. It was a great time to be at Harvard. It was the golden age. Between 1909 1916, he taught at BYU. Got caught up in what was called the modernism controversy. If you want to read about that, I published on it as well as other people. This is about evolution and higher criticism of the Bible. I'm not going to talk about that today. But he eventually had to resign, went back to Harvard for a little while, came back to Utah, taught adjunct at various places, eventually went back to BY College, and died in the flu epidemic of the early 1920s, that followed the First World War. The Spanish flu killed more people than the First World War did. On his deathbed, he was offered a job at BYU. Yeah. Five years after his death, the church published a biography by his brother, Ralph Chamberlain, and required all CES people to read it. And Apostle David O. McKay wrote an apology to his brother for the way his Chamberlain had been treated. It's an interesting history. But I don't want to cover that today. I want to talk about this quote that we started out looking at. This is from a little essay he wrote on Thanksgiving in The White and the Blue. That used to be the Daily Universe at BYU back in 1911. The gospel is so beautiful, our story is so beautiful, that even if it wasn't true, there would be no reason we can't make it true. It's an interesting statement, okay? And I remember doing a paper on this down at BYU once, and there was a guy down there I know, I won't remain unnamed, and I was afraid he was going to throw holy water on me or something. But you got to understand, Chamberlain is really committed to Mormonism. This is an interesting way of looking at what truth is and what the truth of religion really is. And that's what I want to get into with you. But let's keep going. The second sentence is as important as the first. God needs willing earthly hands to build Zion, and it can't be built by celestial beings alone. So that, you know, there's an idea that human beings have to participate in the process of building Zion. Here's another longer quote from a different essay on Christmas. But once again, even if Mormonism were not true, inspired by our love of our fathers, we could make the cause they love true. Now the question is, what did he mean by this? I mean, is he saying that the truth claims that we've all grown up with are not true, but that there is something, but we can somehow fix them? Well, not exactly. Matter of fact, perhaps not at all. What I think he's saying is he's making a claim about truth that's different than what we're used to. And in order to understand that, I'm going to have to give you the nickel tour of the history of philosophy. Yes?
So he used the word gospel before, and you're using the word narrative here. I wonder if you know what he meant, if you could just clarify what he meant by gospel in those contexts, or
the good news. Okay, what gospel means. So
yeah, I
know you know it, but let me clarify it as we go through this. Okay, the truth. Let's just say that the gospel is the truth. That even if it isn't true the way it's been presented to us historically, that it still hits at a greater, more important truth than the kind of stories that sometimes we tell. Okay? Is that a good answer for that?
Good enough for that.
Okay, good. Now, I want you to think about this in relation to what Joseph Smith said about creeds originally. That he can't believe in any of the creeds. There's a theological thing going on here, right? Think of the Nicene Creed. Think of attempts to define religion in theological terms. Okay, he says, they have some things in them that I cannot subscribe to. They all have some truth, but I want to come into the presence of God to learn all things. But creeds set up stakes and say, hitherto thou shalt come and no further, which I cannot subscribe to. So somehow entering into the presence of God, what ultimate truth would be different than, say, propositions, creeds, statements that we make about truth. Okay. Now, like I said, once again, in order to get at this, we've got to do the nickel tour of the history of philosophy. And I want to refer to this classic book that most of you probably read sometime in your life, or at least looked at, Sterling McMurrin's Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion. I was raised in a weird family. They weren't intellectuals. My dad worked at Kennecott Copper. My mom was a nurse. Well, they were intellectuals, but not the kind we usually think of. But my dad was big into B.H. Roberts and John A. Witsow. My mom would talk about Lowell Bunyan and Sterling McMurrin and T.A. Edgar Lyon. So I grew up kind of thinking that McMurrin was a general authority. There were so many of them that, you know. And I remember coming home from my mission, and I bought this book at Deseret Bookstore. You could buy it there then. And I went down to BYU. After my mission president talked me into going to BYU. And I remember my meeting with my bishop down there, and he asked me, what gospel study are you doing? And I said, I'm reading Sterling McMurrin's Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion. It didn't go over well. But anyway, I love this book, but I have problems with it too. One thing is it's short, and it kind of functioned in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as the Mormon doctrine for Mormon liberals. Okay? So if we just look at the title, Theological Foundations, that's both good and bad. One, it is good because, you know, it says that, you know, there are ways that we can think about Mormonism theologically. And what McMurrin does is ties us into different traditions of philosophy that would be helpful for Mormons to look at. What's bad about it is it implies that perhaps we can reduce Mormonism or religion to creeds, to theology, which I don't think we can do or should do. Okay? I mean, the theme of this symposium is many Mormonisms. You can play all sorts of theologies off religious revelations. One of them is personalism. This was a big movement in American and European philosophy, still around. Not as big as it used to be. Ephraim Erickson used to be chair of the philosophy department at the University of Utah. And he noticed in Chamberlain this kind of personalist impulse. Okay. So he wrote an article about Chamberlain back in the 30s. And talks about how Chamberlain's philosophy was Mormon. That it emphasized the eternal nature of both God and human beings, and the metaphysical, this is the what I want to emphasize here, the metaphysical ultimacy of persons. What does that mean? This means that if you want to know what truth is, don't think ultimately about logical propositions. Look at the person next to you. That's truth. Okay. Now, that's going to take a little unpacking. So I'm going to try and do that. Here's a brief history of genealogy of personalism in Europe and America. I go back to the 17th century German mystic Jakob Berma. I've written about this in the Journal of Mormon History and things like and elsewhere. But I'm going to just talk about these guys. Immanuel Kant, French philosopher Henri Bergson, the French Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. He died in 1995. He's fairly current. And I'll mention these two guys, George Holmes Howison and Josiah Royce. Put this guy's name up here because he was Sterling McMurrin's teacher at the University of Southern California and directed McMurrin's dissertation. Down here, famous tradition of Boston personalism. Probably the most famous one here is, of course, Martin Luther King, who... You know, if you read King and you know Boston personalism, you can see it in his writings. Although, you know, King is writing for a much wider group than philosophers. Smart guy. Okay, so let's do the nickel tour. I want to talk about the problem in the history of philosophy that we're going to be confronting. Time, creativity, and freedom. How you think about time, how you think about creativity, and how you think about freedom, what it means, really determines in a lot of ways what you think truth is, and what you think ethics is, and what you think is most important in life. Here's a nice quote from one of my favorite philosophers, a guy named Alfred North Whitehead. Philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. Plato, you probably all heard of Plato, great Greek philosopher, who, as Martin Heidegger said, really got us going on the idea of truth and at the same time really screwed us up. Okay? But that's what's going to happen. Whenever you say anything, you cover some things up. Let's take a look at... I'm going to give you a kind of negative view of Plato. I love Plato. Plato does many wonderful things. He's one of the greatest philosophers of all time. But I'm going to give you a very negative view in my nickel tour of philosophy. Remember, this is the cheap tour. Plato gives us an idea that truth is eternal, unchanging, and it's not anything that you experience in the world. If you read his wonderful essay, wonderful dialogue, excuse me, the Symposium, we're told that we want to have children because we want to be immortal, but it's better to write books than have children because they are really immortal. And even best of all is to just come into contact with the eternal, unchanging ideals. Okay. We can do that. We've experienced truth. A really good example of this is in Dante, at the end of the Divine Comedy. Remember, in the Paradiso, Dante is being led through paradise by Beatrice, the woman that he loves. They come at the end to the beatific vision of God in eternity, and they turn away from each other and stare at eternity. Because any finite individual does not hack it in relation to ultimate truth. Okay? I love the Divine Comedy, but this bugs me. That's why hell is so much more interesting in the Divine Comedy than paradise. That's why hell is always so, you know, what Mark Twain said, go to hell, go to heaven for the climate, hell for the company. So, but notice this, how this works with the problem of evil as well. This is from Plotinus, Neoplatonist, highly influential, not a Christian, who says, you know, think about suffering. Human beings suffering in a finite world. He says, we are like people ignorant of a painting who complain the colors are not beautiful everywhere in the picture, but the artist has laid the appropriate tint to every spot. So if you just take God's point of view, you could see those people dying of heat exhaustion and terrorism and whatnot in Syria are just part of a great, beautiful picture. If you've read Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, this is what drives Ivan crazy. What if you're not in the pretty part of the picture? What if you're in the dark spot? That's important. Augustine picks this up from a Christian point of view. And we get this in the Confessions. Now, I know we could argue about this, and we should, but like I say, I'm giving a negative view here, and it's the nickel tour. But from God's point of view, in eternity, there is no such thing as evil. Because evil, if you think of, let's compare Shakespeare and the Brady Bunch. Which do you think is the most significant work of art? I'd go for Shakespeare. I'd go for, you know, Macbeth, Hamlet, over the Brady Bunch. But even in the Brady Bunch, Marcia has to get hit in the nose with a football or it wouldn't be interesting at all. Okay. So, you know, we get the dark spots of the painting because it makes the painting more and more interesting. The only problem is if you're one of the dark spots. Even hell becomes an important part of the painting because it fills out the total picture of justice. So we get the great chain of being, which, notice this is all in eternity, too. So you've developed certain problems of things. Everything's in its place. This is why the French Revolution is so important, because you kill a king who's supposed to be there. So here's the problems here. Eternity is static, unchanging, and total. The philosopher Emmanuel Levinas will talk about totalizing views of the world, where we take a total view of the world, like the great chain of being, and we fit everyone into it. Now, you can see how this might tend toward violence. Say you're a heretic. You're rebelling against the ideal totality created by God. Say you're not even a heretic. You're just wrong. Okay, you can see how, or another religion. Okay. You can see how violence can arise because you have to be removed. The Albigensians in the Middle Ages were duelists. They had to be removed. It's not just that they're wrong, they're demonic. So, eternity is truth. Eternity is beauty. There's certain advantages to this. We could establish that Beethoven is better than Justin Bieber this way, which is, you know, good. But time is less than real. Only God is creative. And human freedom is either negative or perhaps non-existent. Think of what we get with Luther and Calvin and ideas of predestination. Because God knows everything in eternity, the totality. So he knows what you're all going to be eating for lunch right now, even if you don't. And he knows whether you're saved or damned. You've been created for that. Okay? Now, start talking about how this changes. And now, let me back up just a second and say there's a non-theistic version of this as well. We still have it around. We think that, you know, there, we live in a block universe. Everything was determined from the Big Bang on. There is no human freedom. I mean, Spinoza does this, the great 17th century Dutch Jewish philosopher. He just associates God with nature. Okay. So what alternatives are there? One is offered by one of the greatest philosophers of all time, Immanuel Kant. If you want to go to the Unemployed Philosophers Guild, you can get that finger puppet and have it at home. But he writes three great books, The Critique of Pure Reason, The Critique of Practical Reason, and The Critique of Judgment. In them, he talks about what I can know, what I should do, and what I can hope for. Now, this is the one he's really interested in because he wants to somehow figure out how can we talk about human beings being free. Now, if everything is caused, how is it that you can be free? So what he splits is the world of the understanding, where we look at everything as a machine, and the world of freedom, where we look at everything as a choice, an ethical choice. Now, let me give you an example. Notice how this is called practical reason. Say you're going to lunch sometime today. You hungry yet? Anybody? Oh, nobody? Okay, good. You just had breakfast. But soon you will be hungry, and you will walk downstairs, and you will choose in the food court between the pizza and the hamburger. And, you know, you could look at that as that's a causal relationship. You know, chemicals get moving in the brain. You know, from the point of view of the understanding of theory, it's all causal. But when you're standing there making the decision, practically, it sure as hell doesn't seem causal. So you can theoretically live in the realm of everything's caused, but you can't practically live there. You can't live your life like that. You have to feel like you're making, you have to act like you're actually making choices. That's why B.F. Skinner didn't make any sense when he wrote that book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Because he said that we should, use that word, start conditioning people so they'll act the right way. Well, if we should, then, you know, we've been, if we're totally conditioned from the beginning, we can't do the should thing. That implies a choice. But Kant had a big problem. He never resolves it. Because one thing is, this one has to do with the body and bodies in motion. This one has to do with the will. How do we get them together? He tries to work it out in his book on art, on beauty, called The Critique of Judgment. Okay, now, this is... I teach philosophy of art. I think this is fun. But that's what I do for a living. How many of you have ever gotten an argument with your kids about the beautiful? About beautiful music? Beautiful art? Anything? Okay? Now, we could go the one way, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. There's some truth to that, but it's not completely true. In that he says, the judgment of taste, this is beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is not based on concepts, otherwise it would admit of controversy, would be determined by proofs. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, let's take something that can be determined by proofs. Really easy. 2 + 2. Anybody?
4.
Good. Anybody disagree? Good. You had no choice in that, right? That's, you know, we could talk about other things that can be determined by proofs as well. Beauty can't be. Okay? But there's an antithesis to this. The judgment of taste is based on concepts. Otherwise, despite their diversity, we could not quarrel about it. Now, we're kind of wimps in the 21st century. We don't quarrel about these things, but people used to. And they probably still should. Because I really do think Gustav Mahler is better than Justin Bieber. And I don't think, you know, opinion polls are going to bear that out. But I'm right and they're wrong. This is the way we feel about things. When we experience the beautiful, when you see something like a sunset out here, and you say, look at that, and somebody says, yeah, it looks really better through Kennecott smog. And I think, well, nah, you know, we got to get back to... Well, these are important arguments, but they can't be determined completely by proofs. But we can argue about them rationally. We can use concepts. And what Kant says we're getting at here is an idea that as human beings we see purposiveness in things. Now that used to be the idea that, you know, I can look at the order of the universe and I can deduce from that that there's a God. Kant says that doesn't work. And we could go into that and why he says it doesn't work. And I don't think it works either. But he says, but as human beings, we want it to work. When I see something as beautiful, I see it as fitting together. I frame it. Like if you're a photographer or a painter, you frame it in a particular way. You see that sunset and you see that a kind of order there. Now, can you prove that the order that you see is there? No. Can you hope for it? Yes. And that is a project of the imagination. So for Kant, in the third critique, the imagination becomes very important. Human beings creatively look for order in the world. He calls this, they're hoping for some kind of supersensible ground, a meaning to things. There's a Bierstadt of the Redwoods. I was just in California. You know, it's beautiful. You know, you want there to be some kind of order to the universe. Of course, it's possible that there's not. But what Kant is saying, there really ought to be. Go back and think about what Chamberlain's saying. If it wasn't true, there's no reason we can't make it true. it ought to be true. The most important things perhaps have to do with beauty, with oughtness, with trying to bring an order and justice to the world. So Kant looks at this problem this way. Eternity is unknown. Time is a human intuition. So we've made progress. We're going to move past this. Freedom is formal. He actually thought that there were ethical rules. You all heard this, perhaps, categorical imperative, that which is a version of the golden rule, that I should only act in such a way that anybody else could do it. Okay.
You should act out of motives that you want other people to act out of.
Yes. Yeah, I can't, like, for example, I can't universalize murder, because then we'd all kill each other. But I can universalize not murder, because then we'll all still be alive. Yeah. Or I can't universalize lying, because then everybody's lying wouldn't work anymore. But I can universalize truth-telling. But if you think about that, that has problems. Okay, because what if some guy, if I lent my gun to some crazy guy and he ran in here and wanted his gun back so he could, and he was wondering where Ron Huggins is. You know, Ron's back there. I should probably lie to him. I don't have it. Okay, let's move forward. I'm going to skip this. These are Chamberlain's teachers, and they got involved in a big debate. It fits into what we're talking about here. Royce was trying to prove the existence of God through something like the ontological argument, which means error is incomplete knowledge. So error implies that there's complete knowledge somewhere, meaning there has to be a God with complete knowledge. Howison thought there was a real flaw to this. There it is. You know, you only get to the omniscience of an individual knower, or the individual is swallowed up in God. And, you know, it would take a while to explain this. But he says Royce has a moral intuition that saves him, that makes him think about what Royce called a blessed community. Royce actually, in his later writings, after this debate in 1895, said that God was a community of persons. And if I had a long time, I'd love to talk about that with you because it fits so well with Chamberlain. But notice, around this time, we start thinking about God in different ways. And here's a famous one from William James. That God is no gentleman. That his menial services are needed in the dust of our human trials, even more than his dignity is needed in the Imperium. So God had to come down and somehow become part of time and space and suffering. Okay. And the philosopher, I think, that really does this an amazing way, and we could look at him as kind of a, James saw this as a, him as a Copernican revolution in thought, is this guy Henri Bergson. Anybody ever hear of Bergson? For some people, yeah. Won the Nobel Prize in Philosophy Nobel Prize in Literature in 1927. He was a great thinker. But notice, Chamberlain was teaching him at BYU the last years he was there. Bergson moves us to an idea of time as being creative. And in fact, he says time is creative or it's nothing at all. He says we have an intuition of this. Our basic intuition of reality is the experience of time. And he writes a book called Time and Free Will. Okay. Very first thing he'd written. In which he talks about time as this experience of the new. Now, how do we think about that? That the new can never be reduced to its parts. Think of your kids. They're part you, they're part your spouse, and yet they're something wholly different. Like I remember telling my boys that when we were going to a conference in Chapel Hill, they were in high school, telling them never to have anyone in the house. It was possible that weekend that they wouldn't have had a party. It was possible. They could have surprised me. It could have happened. But, you know, there's something incredibly new that happens. Or any of you who do art see this all the time. You have the idea in your head. You have the medium you're working in. And when you create something, it's more than the idea in your head, and it's more than the medium you were working in. That's the new. That's what was created. Bergson thought this was the nature of reality. I'm going to skip Durkheim here. In 1932, he wrote a book called Two Sources of Morality and Religion, in which, well, no, I won't skip Durkheim. Durkheim's too much fun. Emil Durkheim is one of the great founders of sociology. He wrote a book called The Elementary Forms of Religious Life in 1912, in which he said, religion is the source of morality, and it is a sort of social conformity. Okay? I'll give you an example of that. He was interested in Aboriginal tribes in Australia. And say, okay, we are wandering in the outback. We're an Aboriginal tribe. We are members of the Wallaby clan. Okay? We don't see each other very often. Because, you know, we've got to go range far and wide for food. We get together once a year and dance around the Wallaby. And it's an incredible social rush. How many of you ever been to a pep rally back in high school? I remember playing football at Olympus High and actually believing after some of these things that we were going to win. But you have this tremendous social rush. Big group of people. We all look to the Wallaby and say, blessed Wallaby ties us all together. That's religion. Eventually we get God out of that. Okay, that's the 2-cent tour of Durkheim, but that's eventually it. Religion then is social control. He's very pessimistic about the future. This is like Freud, because once we realize that religion is social control, society has lost a lot of its control. Let's just think about it. Thou shalt not kill, written in hands of fire on Sinai, or because it's not nice to do, society says it's a bad thing. Which one has more power? Durkheim is concerned about the future of civilization. Bergson picks up on this and writes this book, Two Sources of Morality and Religion, and says there are two sources, actually, that Durkheim doesn't look at the whole picture, because religion, like time, is creative. There's a closed source, which is essentially Durkheim's view. It is social, conservative, and preserves the structures of society. It's the rules. We have all experienced religion this way. Okay. There's an open source, though. It's creative, challenges the social structures, and centers in what he called creative love. Okay. And he looks at religious innovators, from Moses to Jesus to the Buddha, and says, you know, these are people who are living in the open source of religion. Now, what's important for Bergson is that both of these are absolutely necessary. If you have the first, it solidifies everything. It institutionalizes everything. And the tendency is toward a kind of idolatry, kind of death of things. Any of you who have experienced correlation on Sunday sometimes, try and remember when you experience the scriptures in another way, okay? Although it can happen on Sunday in correlation stuff. The problem with the open source, if we were merely open to everything, we'd be in total chaos. We would have no material to work with. The past gives us the material. The past is the medium that we work in. Think of, you know, what Joseph Smith said about creeds, or what Brigham Young later said about the Book of Mormon. 20 years afterwards, he said, no, 30 years afterwards, if it was translated now, it would be translated differently. That's really fascinating that those guys thought that way. Okay. I remember coming across this book when I was a Mormon missionary, not understanding most of it, but getting really, really excited when I read the last page. This is the last sentence of Bergson's book. Theirs is the responsibility, then, for deciding whether they, humanity, merely want to live or intend to make just the extra effort required for fulfilling, even on their refractory planet, the essential function of the universe, which is a machine for making gods. Now, I was a Mormon, so I read that in a really Mormon way, and I just, but it's an interesting idea. I'm going to conclude. So here we have the problem. Eternity is time for Bergson. Time is, forget the synchronic duration, that would take a while to explain, but time is freedom. Time, and hence everything and everyone, is creative. The divine and the human are one, and truth is creativity. Let me add, end with just, I'm going to have to cut this guy short, Emmanuel Levinas. I think, you know, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, Jewish, writing after the Holocaust, wrote a book called Totality and Infinity. Think of Bergson's two sources of morality and religion. Totality would be the closed source, what preserves, but is also dangerous, can become an idol. Infinity, the open source. What I find interesting in Levinas is infinity, for Levinas, is found in the face of other people. He goes to Durkheim once again for a negative view of religion. You know, the social conformity. Think of a Nazi rally. His family was wiped out in World War II. He was from Lithuania. There were 200,000 Lithuanian Jews in 1935. There are about 2,000 today. But then, you know, I remember reading Durkheim and thinking, testimony meeting. You know, I'm moved by the Spirit when in relation to others. That's a positive thing, but it also can be enormously negative. If that's all it is? It's just warm, fuzzy feelings I get from being with other people? What Levinas does is he defines the holy differently than what we usually think of as the sacred. The holy is in relation to another person who transcends me and my ideas. You are always more, because you are creative, you are always more than the image, the totality I make of you. But then, so is God. So is everybody. And that is what leads us to a notion of transcendence that gets away from the violence of the world. That recognition of the otherness of the other. Now, this is, you know, he wrote some really remarkable philosophical arguments justifying this position that I can't get into. But just think about language. Why do we have language? We have language because none of us invented it. We have language always in relation to others. We have consciousness, largely because we live with others. If you've ever seen Werner Herzog's remarkable film, The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, about a 19th century German case of a guy locked in a closet for the first 20 years of his life. He has no memory of his time in the closet. He only has memory once he starts to interact with other human beings. So Levinas will say, the face of the other calls me into question, makes me wonder, you know, what I should do. When you're walking down the street and somebody asks you for a dollar, you're called into question. When you object to everything I just said in this talk, you called me into question. I've developed a nice totality here. But that calling into question, he says, that's what religion is. He says, that's ethics. It's not the corollary vision of God. It is the very vision of God. I see God in the face of other people. To know God, then, is to know what must be done. It's to know that I have a responsibility to others. So, time and eternity, according to Levinas, are diachronic, meaning we all live in time immediately, like Bergson said, but we have slightly different experiences of time. Time is real. It's infinite. You know, think about when you're talking to somebody and you develop that image of them in your mind and then they say something that breaks the image. I've been married to my wife for 39 years. She is constantly breaking my image of her, which is a wonderful thing. Ethics is creative freedom. Sociality is what we aim at. The other is the divine. We have a religion. This is Chamberlain's idea here, in which we believe other human beings are divine, or at least potentially divine. That is fabulous. I think it's beautiful. I think it's one of the most beautiful ideas in the history of religion. So it's this that Chamberlain means when he says that our gospel is so beautiful. There's the answer to that question. That human beings are divine. We might even be able to expand that. Because remember, Joseph Smith thought dogs had gods in heaven. You know, there's something wonderful about that kind of earthiness.
Sorry.
There was a god dog. Okay. Smith said all sorts of just wonderfully weird things. And God needs our earthly hands to build Zion. It can't be built by celestial beings alone. Which I think is Chamberlain's version of this. Section 130 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verses 1 and 2. That when the Savior shall appear, we shall see him as he is. We shall see that he is a man like ourselves. And that same sociality that exists among us here will exist among us there, only it will be coupled with an eternal glory, which glory we do not now enjoy. I think that's our great hope. And as Chamberlain said, even if it isn't true, it ought to be. Thank you.
Awesome. We have about 10 minutes for any questions you may have, and then we'll be on our way. So please take this opportunity.
Yeah.
When's the book coming out?
I've been talking about that for about 10 years now. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been writing this book on hell too. And then I got this. I've had this thing 90% done for 10 years. No, 15. But then, you know, in Ralph Chamberlain's biography, he talked about all these essays that I just figured were gone. And I came out here last summer, and somebody just donated them to the church history library. All his papers he wrote for Royce, his essay on Jesus, I just got a hold of all of them, so now it's taken longer. Well, I talked to Coford, and they're going to let me do two volumes, the one that I have finished and then these that I found. Yeah.
Chamberlain and his brother and the other guy.
The Peterson brothers? Yeah.
They were fired now.
Well, Chamberlain wasn't fired. None of them were actually fired. They all resigned.
I know, but...
Yeah.
Who was in their corner? Were BH or any of those intellectual authorities going to bat for them, or was there no communication throughout it, or what?
It's an interesting... it's fairly complicated what was going on. Joseph F. Smith was really concerned that we would develop a two-tiered Mormonism. He didn't want us even talking about evolution. Not that he was against evolution, he just said, you know, because the official church announcement of the thing is, we don't take a position. But Joseph F. Smith was concerned that you'd have a kind of elite intellectual group and then everybody else. And, you know, and that's a problem. I mean, I think it's a serious problem. And so there were people like Brimhall, who was head of CES at the time, who, no, he was head of BYU. The guy that was, I can't remember his name right now. He was the one that really kind of pushed them out, but they really didn't get much support from the general authorities. Cummings, yes, thank you. Years ago, I did a paper on this, and his grandson responded to it, and he was on my side. So that, you know, that's progress. Okay, but yeah. I think it was a really unfortunate thing, but it was going on everywhere. Borden Parker Bown at Boston University was accused of heresy. He was upheld. But it wasn't just among us. It was going on all over, and it still is. I mean, this battle is still being fought. And part of the paper, part of one of the things that we could have gone into. Think of somebody like William Jennings Bryan. You know, big opposer to evolution. Why is Bryan so opposed to it? For moral reasons. He's opposed to Herbert Spencer and social Darwinism. That's his big concern. I mean, we paint this kind of a really sorry picture of Bryan. He's really concerned that people are going to use this to justify social Darwinism, and a lot of people were. Yeah, Ron.
I was wondering, do you know the philosopher
Henry Nelson Wyman? Yeah.
How does he fit in this? He was,
Yeah, he's kind of in Whitehead's camp at Chicago. You know, you get the Chicago school of Chicago naturalism, and they kind of go with process. And so, yeah, he does fit in here. I don't know him that well. But they tend to move more toward a really naturalist version of process theology. Wyman and there's a whole group of them. I've got a cold and my brain is not working. So the transcendent kind of drops out of the picture. What I like about Levinas is the transcendent remains in the picture, even though the transcendent is kind of redefined as the face of the other person. In what happens with Chicago naturalism, you get more of an ecological, if you draw the genealogy into our present time, it's more of an ecological, almost pantheist notion of religion that you're going to be moving to. Well, y'all going to stay in? No, really. My purpose, one of my purposes in coming here, is I know it's hard. Sometimes, being a Mormon. I live in North Carolina. It's a little easier for me because they just care if I show up. But I think it's worth it. It's a beautiful religion. It's highly institutionalized, which in some ways is good, meaning it's going to be around for a while. But in some ways, is oppressive. So just, Martin Buber, who's one of my favorite philosophers, said, the human can be anywhere, even in the most dehumanized factory. All you have to do is look up and smile at somebody else. And We do it in Mormonism all the time. We crack jokes. I mean, Kirby has done more for the church than I think a lot of people. Okay. Why do we remember J. Golden Kimball and none of the rest of them? Okay. Yeah.
I really liked your discussion about the static versus the dynamic, the creative. And it reminded me that it's much deeper here, but Orson Scott's Card is an analogy to a body that needs both bones and muscles. If
yeah.
It's just muscles, it's quivering on the floor, it's just bones. It's a statue. What do they call it? Anyway. And I try to view our role as the role of the muscles and honor the fact that there are bones, but that I have to act like a muscle. And that gives me a role that I'm proud of.
Yeah, and you know, and you know, the wonderful 46th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. I mean, I am, I got asked to be a bishop a few years ago, and I was only bishop for a year because I went on sabbatical and got out of it afterwards. I told them I was going on sabbatical. Yeah, I live in North Carolina. They don't have a lot of choices. But I remember telling my stake president, I'm the least spiritual person you've ever met. I've never had a spiritual experience. He says, well, you like the people, don't you? And I says, yeah, I like the people. And he says, that's all you need to do. So, you know, some of us are in that place. You know, we're the people in the 46th section that listen to other people who've had spiritual experiences, and maybe we trust them. Maybe we think, that's beautiful. I'd like it to be true. I don't know. But what we can do, we can bring what we have. I believe that we should be good to each other. And so, you know, that's something we bring to the table. Yeah?
In your model of static and creative, does that go back and forth? Because right now I think we're in a highly static function, little revelation coming out from Paul Lake.
Well, you see,
Smith, he was, you know, I'm creative, and I'm sure there are other problems. Right now we don't have that.
But what's great about what Bergson's doing here, and what's great about, I think, about Mormonism is we have received this idea of revelation that I think is, you know, people with power tend to want to keep it. And so we always think of revelation comes from the top down. But if you think of the Spirit, the way the Spirit works in the world, it comes from top down and it goes from the bottom up. Now that's what Chamberlain's saying here. Zion isn't built by celestial hands alone. You have to get it. You know, what does Israel mean? To wrestle with God and win. We got to wrestle with Salt Lake. You know, sometimes. I mean, you got to remember, you like these people. They're doing the best job they can do. They're wrong sometimes. We're wrong. I'm wrong all the time. But you know, that's what the wrestle is. Don't give up. You know? If we just run off to, you know, our own ways, that's nice, but not going to get anything done.
That reminds me, my husband always says that it's a good thing that everybody in the church isn't like, if everybody like him went off and made their own church, it would not work at all. You know, we need some of the other.
Yeah, every once in a while I go and hang with the Unitarians in North Carolina. And I really like them, but, you know, I couldn't do it. You know, there's about 20 of them, and they're all, you know, older than me. Wesley Wildman, he gave a sermon that got into dialogue. He's a professor at Boston U, and a real naturalist. But he once talked about in that sermon something that I think is important. You see this in Elaine Pagel's biography, too. We all more or less come into things with this kind of enthusiastic, but sort of childlike version of religion. And then we're disappointed. You know, we find out that there were three versions of the first vision. Find out that Joseph Smith, oh, there's more. Okay. Learn something new every day at Sunstone. Okay. We find out that, you know, Joseph Smith's polygamy thing wasn't quite what we thought it was. We're disappointed. And then, you know, we go from that to, you know, a kind of more liberal position. But in a way, the liberal positions only exist because the first position existed. And what we really should do is keep working to modify things, to open them up. And the church has opened up considerably. It's gone backwards and forwards. But I remember when I was a kid, most Mormons believed gospel doctrine was the only book they had to read. We're better off now than we were then. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Thank you so much. Please join me for one more hand of applause. What a wonderful...